A white teenager and a black teenager grow up blocks apart in Detroit. One learns that police officers are helpers who will guide him home if he's lost. The other learns that police are threats to hide from, a matter of survival. This isn't ancient history or distant geography. This is America, where your skin color determines which country you actually live in. This revelation struck when a young janitor named Jim Wallace befriended his black coworker Butch and visited his home for the first time. The contrast was undeniable, shocking, impossible to unsee. When Wallace brought his questions to his white church, an elder shut him down. Christianity has nothing to do with racism, that's political, and our faith is personal. That dismissal drove him from his church, but toward a deeper truth that black churches had always known. God is always personal, but never private. Fast forward decades. We've elected our first black president. We've passed landmark civil rights legislation. Yet young black men and women still receive the talk, instructions on how to behave around police to stay alive, while white parents never have this conversation. Every black Little League parent gives it. No white parent does. This radical difference in lived experience isn't about individual prejudice anymore. It's about something deeper, more insidious, and far harder to uproot. Believing that black experience differs fundamentally from white experience marks the beginning of changing white attitudes, but it's only the beginning. America's original sin demands spiritual reckoning. For 246 years, from 1619 to 1865, white Americans, including Christians and their churches, enslaved millions of Africans while nearly exterminating Native Americans. These atrocities didn't just happen in America's past, they shaped its foundation, its institutions, its very bones. Sin must be named before it heals. Today's manifestations remain unmistakable. Dysfunctional urban schools filled with children of color, racialized policing, deliberate voter suppression. White Americans deflect with, "I never owned slaves," or "I'm not racist," missing the point entirely. This isn't about personal guilt, it's about inherited systems. Black people suffer because they're black. White people benefit because they're white, whether they asked for it or not. Biblical repentance offers a path forward. The Hebrew sub demands turning completely from evil. The New Testament's metanoia signifies total transformation of one's controlling values. Dietrich Bonhoeffer condemned cheap grace, forgiveness without repentance, baptism without discipline, communion without confession. This precisely describes how many white churches approached America's racial sins. White people didn't exist until America needed to justify slavery. In Europe, English, French, German, Irish, and Italian groups maintained distinct identities and bitter conflicts. An Irishman was Irish, not white. In America, these diverse Europeans became a single white race, defined not by what they were, but by what they weren't: black, indigenous, or colored. This construction justified slavery and racial oppression. American slavery needed philosophical cover because it contradicted the nation's equality rhetoric. The solution? False ideas of white superiority backed by pseudoscience and twisted theology, originating in the British conquest of Ireland, where the Irish were deemed biologically inferior savages. Today, whiteness operates as an unconscious norm. Many white people hear about racial problems and think those issues concern other people. Whiteness becomes the unspoken default, the assumption that America remains fundamentally a white society with minorities who have racial problems. Beyond sociology, whiteness functions as an idol, a false identity filled with wrongful pride that separates people from God and perpetuates injustice. Research reveals an uncomfortable truth. Beneath our explicit attitudes lie unconscious biases affecting our decisions involuntarily. Harvard's implicit association test shows most Americans, regardless of their own race, display pro-white, anti-black bias. These biases form early through subtle messages from family, neighborhoods, and media absorbed before we develop critical thinking skills. The frightening part? Implicit bias operates automatically without awareness. In police simulations, participants shoot armed Black targets more quickly than white ones. These unconscious biases help explain systemic disparities. Black drivers are 31% more likely to be pulled over, Black offenders receive sentences 10% longer for identical crimes, and Black men are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. When confronted with these realities, white people often experience white fragility, defensive reactions triggered by minimal racial stress. This stems from viewing racism as individual moral failings rather than structural forces. The good news? Implicit biases aren't permanent. They can change through awareness, training, and meaningful relationships with people from different backgrounds. Ferguson, Missouri became America's parable because it revealed how racial complexity doesn't diminish deeper injustice. When Officer Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown in August 2014, the Justice Department told two stories. The first report challenged the hands-up narrative. Physical evidence suggested Brown had fought with Wilson and later advanced toward him, providing insufficient grounds to charge Wilson. But the second report validated protesters' claims about systemic racism. Black residents, comprising 67% of Ferguson's population, faced 85% of vehicle stops, 90% of citations, 93% of arrests, and 100% of police dog bite victims. Ferguson works as a parable precisely because of its complexity. Years of illegal practices created a toxic environment that made the city like a powder keg. The lesson? Racially biased criminal justice systems don't need perfect victims to be fundamentally wrong. Even when suspects may be guilty, this doesn't justify lethal force when de-escalation might work. President Obama captured the deeper truth. This is not just an issue for Ferguson. This is an issue for America. Imagine a justice system focused on repairing harm rather than inflicting punishment. This shift from retributive to restorative justice is gaining momentum through unlikely allies. Faith communities have become powerful advocates. Thousands of Black churches, PICO's Live Free campaign, and the Christian Community Development Association now make mass incarceration a core focus. Politically, Democrat Cory Booker and Republican Rand Paul have introduced bipartisan legislation to help formerly incarcerated people reintegrate. Restorative justice rests on three principles. Crime violates people and relationships. Violations create obligations. The central obligation is putting right the wrongs. Rather than simply punishing offenders, it involves victims, offenders, and community members in the healing process. The President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing identified crucial reforms, acknowledging past mistakes, implementing constitutional training, and deploying body cameras. The school-to-prison pipeline shows how educational systems feed criminal justice, with students of color disproportionately facing suspension, expulsion, or arrest for minor offenses. Aggressive zero-tolerance policies target children of color, with educators often identifying incarceration-bound children as early as elementary school. Breaking this pipeline requires treating discipline as restoration, keeping young people in educational settings rather than pushing them toward incarceration. By 2045, no single race will constitute a U.S. majority, a shift already visible in major cities. The question is, who will provide moral leadership through this transition? Martin Luther King Jr. observed in 1953 that Sunday morning was the most segregated hour in Christian America. 70 years later, this remains true. Most Americans live segregated lives, different neighborhoods, schools, churches, preventing empathy and understanding. 75% of white Americans have entirely white social networks. This geography must be deliberately changed through proximity. Schools, sports teams, and multiracial faith communities offer natural settings for cross-racial connection. The Edmund Pettus Bridge, named after a Confederate general and KKK Grand Dragon, became a symbol of courage when civil rights marchers crossed it. At the 50th anniversary, John Lewis, whose skull was cracked by police that day, introduced President Obama. The next bridge is America's transition to a majority of racial minorities, underlying tensions from policing to immigration to voting rights. Talking isn't enough. We must reform policing, protect voting rights, and fix immigration. As King said, we are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. When Charleston victims' families offered forgiveness to Dylan Roof, they demonstrated spiritual transformation. True repentance requires dying to the false idol of whiteness and being reborn as children of God. Will you walk with us?